the American and European taxpayers. In Europe, they're not very happy about that. They, this criminal stuff. Here, it's like, you know, I'm telling you, this guy's now Romney's chief advisor on the economy. And that's kind of dangerous, because when you look at what he did to Africa, the reason they're called vultures is that they make money when economies die, okay? That's what we're heading towards. It's, you know, that they look at the U.S. economy as a carcass to pick apart. And by the way, in Vultures Picnic, there's also the story about how Singer goes after the, you know, U.S. companies. He grabbed all the asbestos companies out of bankruptcy because they were caught basically murdering their workers, not telling them that asbestos was giving them lung cancer and other diseases. He buys the company, gets George Bush to, in so-called tort reform, to knock out 80% of the compensation to the dying workers. Suddenly these death factories are worth billions, and he pockets it. The guy's worth $4 billion. $3 billion made since the economy collapsed.
This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Light, and we're speaking with Greg Palast about his brand new book, Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum, Pigs, Power, Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And Greg, this book is a diamond. It is a diamond in that it glitters, a diamond in that it cuts through the subterfuges of the oligarchs, and also because it's hard-edged investigative reporting. And I'm just so proud to be speaking with you today, especially on the imminence of a major event with you and WBAI coming up here in New York this Monday at the Community Church, Park Avenue and 35th Street.
And that's right, and I understand even better the real star. It's, don't call me a diamond. The vultures will pick it up right away. It's gone. Yes, the inimitable Robert Knight will be there with Yes Men, with Andy Bickelman of Yes Men. And that. So, and by the way, to get ticks, if you want them cheap, and you can then also get a discount copy of Vultures Picnic in hardback, is go to WBAI.org, look for that event, or GregPalast.com. In the upper right corner, it says WBAI. Click on that. That's the fundraiser for Your Weapon of Mass Destruction in New York. This is the real thing. So please join us. It'll be fun.
Well, Greg Palast, like you, we believe in the release of hazardous information. And I think, well, certainly I'll be there taking part in the evening. And among my heroes, including yourself and the Yes Men and all of the heroes of WBAI who support this more than half a century old institution of revelation. So please contact our website and be there at 7 o'clock, is it?
Yep, we're going to occupy the airwaves with WBAI. And, yeah, we're going to be there and going to have the films. If people want to get an idea, well, who the heck is this berserker, you can go to vulturespicnic.org, where you can also sign up for the ticks for the evening. And by the way, previously we've been sold out, so I do recommend you get there right away. If you go to vulturespicnic.org, you can download the first chapter of the book for free. It says excerpt, and or read it online. The reason I recommend that is that my publisher, which is the biggest publisher in the world, partly owned by the Gaddafi family, said, do not give out the chapters for free because it's against our corporate policy, which means they've never read a Greg Palast book. They just published them. As soon as it says against corporate policy, up on the website it went, including the films that they want to charge you extra for if you get the interactive edition. We'll give them to you for free at the vulturespicnic.org. But most important is that you join us on Monday night, 7 p.m. at the Community Church, 35th near Park, and get the info, get the ticks at gregpalast.com. The upper right-hand corner, there's a yellow button. Can't miss it. And join me and Robert, man.
And, yes, it's published by Dutton, but go to gregpalast.com or WBAI.org or Vultures Picnic and have a fine, informed time with the Vultures Picnic BAI party with Greg Palast this Monday at the Community Church near 35th Street and Park. Thank you so much for joining us today, Greg.
You got it. Thanks, Robert.
See you soon.
And Earthwatch was brought to you live with portions on recording. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, and from Greg Palast being a guest to Gregory McGuire.
You are invited to...
One of these days I will do one show, I don't know which, in which the opening is going to work out properly. Okay, where's my wolf? I've got the right thing turned up. I've pressed play. Let's try that again. Well, you know, it just worked fine in the Q channel. I thought I was well prepared. You know what? Switch to another medium over here. I want my wolf. I'm pretty sure I got a copy here. Nope. Okay, so let's just pretend that my intro went out perfectly fine. And, it's just not coming through now, is it? Aha! There it is! Just in time for the voiceover. Well... That one was my fault, by the way. Not like last week. And good morning. This is Our the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning on recording from November 3rd, an interview and reading by Gregory McGuire, author of, the latest book is Out of Oz, but trust me about this, it's wicked. Well, fumbled again, but not quite so badly. Good morning. Announcements, first thing, always. Next Tuesday, December 6th, by the way, happy December, everybody. Next Tuesday will be the 6th, and on the 6th, the New York Review of Science Fiction will be having its... December reading. It's holiday season reading. And the line that I always take, because this has become an annual event, is that everybody does their family event. You know, when you watch television on local news shows and stuff, all of a sudden you'll see the people behind the scenes will come out along with their families and stuff like that. It's a family time. And at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, well, we do the same thing. We just, you know, use a broader definition of family than a lot of people out there. Our family, and it has been this way now for a few years, it consists of Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, two of the finest writers out there, and a happy couple married in, at least two, I think in Massachusetts and in Toronto, and performing for us every December, and they always have incredible new material. As has been our wont, our host for the evening will be Claire Wolf-Smith. I'll introduce the evening, but then it's all up to Claire to introduce Ellen and Delia, but I'll tell you a little bit about each. And by the way, on a show in which I'm this morning featuring Gregory Maguire, these are two very appropriate people in that line. They all have a great deal to do with great American fantasy. Ellen Kushner's first novel, Swords Point, introduced reader to the city, which she has since returned in The Privilege of the Sword, which was a Nebula nominee, The Fall of the Kings, which she co-authored with Delia Sherman, and a handful of short stories, most recently The Duke of Riverside. I've got to say, by the way, it doesn't matter if you're into typical fantasy in semi-medieval places. This one doesn't even rely on magic or dragons or anything like that. This is just different. It's sort of like medieval set fantasy for those who don't like medieval set fantasies. I think it's a good way to put it. She has just finished recording, and actually I think it's just about released, the audiobook of Swords Point for Audible.com on the Neil Gaiman Presents list. Her second novel, Thomas the Rhymer. I hope regular listeners to my show know the name Thomas the Rhymer. Won both the Mythopoeic Award and the World Fantasy Awards. Kushner has taught writing at the Clarion and Odyssey workshops as a co-founder of the Interstitial Arts Foundation. In 2011, she co-edited Welcome to Bordertown with Holly Black. And by the way, let me remind people, if you go to YouTube and type in Welcome to Bordertown and look at the book trailer, well, I'm in there. I'm one of the actors. Kushner's, you'll guess which one. Outside of Ann Bobby, the newscaster, I'm the only person over, 20 years old. Kushner is also the longtime host of the public radio program Sound and Spirit. She now lives in New York City with Delia Sherman and No Cats. Now, Delia Sherman, on the other hand, writes novels and stories for younger readers and adults. Her most recent short stories have appeared in the young adult anthology Steampunk and in Ellen Datlow's Naked City. She's written three novels for adults, Through a Brazen Mirror, The Porcelain Dove, and The Fall of the Kings. She has now turned her hand to novels for younger readers. Changeling and The Magic Mirror of the Mermaid Queen are both set in the magical world of New York Between. Her newest novel, The Freedom Maze, that's just out now, is a time travel historical about antebellum Louisiana. When she's not writing, Sherman is teaching, editing, knitting, and cooking. When not on the road, one of her favorite places to be, she lives in a rambling apartment in New York City with partner Ellen Kushner and far too many pieces of paper. I think that we should say that it also has no cats whatsoever because, well, Ellen cited that. Okay, where and when? Again, well, this is this coming Tuesday, December 6th, at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. That's between Prince and Houston. And admission is free, but we do ask for donations on your way in to help cover expenses and to buy dinner for our readers, which are actually our main expense. Doors open at 6:30, and for more information, well, send me an email, Jim, at ourwolf.com. And I do hope to see you there. These are always fun events. Oh, yes, for those who are interested in the various things that each of these people write, they always come and sell them. Ellen's Klezmer Nutcracker, and I don't know if she'll have her audiobook. I don't know if that's a physical thing or only available through download, since it's audible.com. But there'll be books, there'll be cider, there'll be cheese and crackers. There'll be Ellen and Delia and Claire. Good enough reasons. Okay, let's get to this morning's program. What does one say about really enchanting, wonderful books? And being the beginning of December, it seems the right time to be slightly magical about things. And one place that I've rarely dealt with on this program is Oz. And that's too bad, because there's Oz and then there's The Wizard of Oz. You know, there are the books by L. Frank Baum and a lot of the things that have sprung forth from that. And then there's MGM. Now, I've got nothing against the MGM, other than the fact that it's really derived from L. Frank Baum and not really, it doesn't really offer the same gist that he had. I mean, the stuff is so political and satirical. These are not books for young readers. These are adult books. People make that mistake also with the books by Gregory Maguire. Now, he's written a ton of different books, many of them fantasy, some of them not. But at one point, he wrote a book called simply Wicked, which, well, tells us a lot. And you know, a few weeks ago, I broadcast an interview recorded in June with Jeff Ryman, whose book Was is also an amazing Oz derivative work. That one's a little bit older. But Wicked, you know, was pretty good on its own. It did well on its own. And then somebody said, hey, if we all, you know, get together and stay on camera, we can put on a show. And it's been running on Broadway to huge sums of money for about 8 years now. But I haven't seen the show, but the books are absolutely wonderful, well worth reading. And if you don't have the money to buy the books, well, there's always a library. The fourth book and the final book in The Wicked Years is just out now. And you know what? The rest of it is actually on this recording. So rather than just tell you all about it, why not go to that interview itself? If hopefully I don't foul this up again. It runs, it has a wonderful reading in it. It runs a little bit over an hour. So let's listen. Begin by slating this, as they say in the movie biz. And today is, about November 3rd?
I think so.
And I'm here in the WBAI studios with Gregory Maguire, and it is such a pleasure. There are two people listening who don't know who Gregory Maguire is, and we need to fill them in. You are doubtless best known for Wicked, the full title of which is...
The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. That is, Wicked is first, and then a very important colon, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, is the subtitle.
Right. And that was first published when?
1995.
Okay. And that, of course, became a famous musical, a huge success, which has never stopped playing in New York.
It's like 8 years on. It's still the top... The top money spinner every year.
Yeah, and then which is amazing. I haven't seen it.
Well, I think it's going to run for at least three more weeks. So you have
some time. At least through the holiday season. I know. No, it's weird because having loved the books,
I do like Stephen Schwartz musicals for the most part. You know, I loved Pippin, liked The Magic Show. That was not as hot about something else, but no, I like him. So why I haven't, I know I haven't seen it. I didn't get into press previews when I could have, and Broadway is dear.
Yes. That was nasty. That opportunity should come again. They should do press previews once a decade, don't you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. As a member of the press, yes, absolutely. I feel that's the case. But this is only the tip of the iceberg of an amazingly prolific career. And then, now, you see, here I am. I'm not holding the cheat sheets, although I've been sent some, well, at least one for Out of Oz, just published by... It's Harper, isn't it? No, Morrow. I'm sorry, how dare I say Harper? It's William Morrow. And this is the fourth book.
That's right.
In The Wicked Years. When you, well, we'll get back to the other work, but when you started Wicked, when you finished Wicked, I should say, did you know there would be more in the series?
No, I didn't. I figured any book that starts with a green-skinned baby being born on the first page and ends with her somewhat splashy exit on the last page really doesn't leave much room for a sequel. I mean, she's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while before the gas, let me say the well filled up again.
Mm-hmm.
It filled up for several reasons. One is that Wicked and its sequels are ways that I have of inflicting myself with therapy about the state of our nation. And I pour into the Land of Oz those aspects of culture that most disturb me about being an American in the last 16 years. Well,
which I dare say might have been true for Baum.
I suspect yes. And so there it is. I have often said Oz is the only metaphor that I can think of for the United States that is exactly the same size as the United States. I mean, Gotham City is not the United States. It's a city. You know, Doonesbury is a collection of people, but Oz is a nation. And so I consider it a national canvas, and I can pour upon that national canvas when I go to write in it aspects of the news and contemporary struggles that most disturb me. This really does save me a lot in therapy. And when the I had no idea of writing a sequel, because, as I say, how can you write a sequel about a character who's dead? Until the day the Boston Globe came across my threshold and I saw the photographs from Abu Ghraib above the fold. And when I saw the picture of the man who was standing on a box with a hood on his head and his arms extended and I think electrodes fastened to his fingers, I saw red, and I felt sure that if we lived anyplace else, the publication of this photograph would bring the government down. But that's not how our government works, and it didn't bring it down. So in order to maintain my sanity, I had to deal with my sense of fecklessness and impotence, I suppose, by going to another place that seemed just as corrupt and showing that I could actually have a little effect there. I could teach them how to organize in the pages of my fiction, even if I'm not so good at that in the United States of America.
Yeah. Oz, in all of its origins and its truest interpretations, has always been extremely dark. And even the, well, what was that awful movie with Larry Seaton? That did Baum actually produce that movie?
I know he did one movie that had, he did an early movie of The Wizard of Oz that had Oliver Hardy.
Yeah, that's the one.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I've never seen that. I've just seen a still from it.
Oh, it is frightening.
Yeah.
Frightening. Well, there is, let's put it this way, it makes minstrelsy look progressive. In its attitudes towards racial stuff. No, there's a lot of horrifying stereotyping in that film. It's only about it's about four reels. So it's about four.
Well, maybe that's
long.
Maybe that's why it's hard to catch a glimpse of. I have never seen that.
Yeah, although I think if you go to archive.org.
Oh, okay. Oh, good.
You can probably get a view of it. And then in 1939, I think that's the third film. It became saccharine. And outside of that, it has always been dark. Not always.
Well, I'm one of the fans of that film that was fairly roundly dismissed, Return to Oz.
I love Return to
Oz. I only saw it once, but it has stuck and stuck and stuck with me.
Yeah, starting with Dorothy may get a lobotomy.
Yes, right. Firuza Balk or
yes.
Balk or something.
Yeah,
Egyptian,
young Egyptian actress who's still working today.
And a lot of intensity. It was a different kind of intensity than Judy Garland's, but nonetheless, she was well cast.
And she was the right age.
Yes, right. We'll get back to that, listeners.
Yes, we will. So Oz is an amazing palette. I think it's the closest thing to a proper American fairy tale as we have got, with all of the darkness of the Grimm household tales and the Perrault stories, except those are all in the short form.
That's true. And I think the only thing that gives it even the slightest competition is Charlotte's Web. But Charlotte's Web is written in a different way, and it's more a domestic rather than a kind of outlandish. And I use the word outlandish in, you know, in the large sense of meaning out of this land.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte's Web is a fable and a fairy tale too, but it's of the domestic variety, whereas Oz is of the foreign. You can't call it sword and sorcery because there's a lot of people in Oz, at least in Baum's Oz, who are pacifists.
Mm-hmm.
They fight all the time, but they're pacifists. So it's not quite sword and sorcery, but it is outlandish. And I'd like my accidental use of that word right just now. I'm going to see if I can remember it.
Mm-hmm. So how did you enter Oz as a writer?
Well,
what had you written beforehand?
I had been an unsuccessful novelist for children for 16 years. I had written about a dozen novels for children, all of which had had good reviews, and none of which had sold. I think none of which had even ever made it into paperback. I mean, they'd sold in hardcover, but they'd never been reprinted.
They sold to editors.
Yes, right. They were published, but they had not sold well. I was never on any award, you know, lists that I knew of. And it was getting increasingly hard to continue to be published.
And in those days, the juvenile or YA market just was not what it is today.
No, it wasn't. And the YA market and the juvenile market has always, you know, had peaks and valleys. But at that particular time, publishers were running very scared about the Texas School Board and the obligation that every book should be for every child in the nation and therefore could have no character.
Mm-hmm.
And I really began to chafe. I wrote a book that had a gay bashing scene, and since it was an ancillary point of the plot instead of a book about gay bashing, the editor made me take it out and said, this is just not, it's not streamlined enough with the plot. And I said, you know what, life is rarely streamlined, and I'm trying to make this story feel like real life. Sometimes we do actually get beaten up on the street on days we haven't put it into our schedule. And so that's part of what this child's life is like. This is the worst possible time for this to happen, and it happens. But I had to I was required to take it out. And at that point, I really began to lose faith in children's publishing. I think a lot has improved since then, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
This was the early 90s.
I mean, today they would ask, oh, could you put something a little more like that in?
Yes.
I know enough people,
right.
Chris Barzak and people who are writing very popular, not children's, but YA books.
Right.
That have gay love or gay bashing, the loneliness of the other.
Right.
Whatever it may be.
Right.
It's actually become quite almost a trope.
Well, but it's not even just that topic, because that's a hot-button topic. But, for instance, in the book that I'm thinking of, I wrote it in the first person, and there were periods of reflection. The character was about 14 or 15, and his father, you know, died on page 9. He felt somewhat obscurely responsible because he wasn't home from his track meet, and they didn't find his father until long after it would have been useful to find him and call 911. And so he puzzles about this through the whole novel. This was published in 1992. And again, the editor made me take out so many passages of reflection where he struggles with the shape of his soul and his culpability that in the end, I put it in the third person, and I made the child 3 years younger, because I thought, if a 14-year-old doesn't actually stop to reflect, then they've got brain damage. That's what 14-year-olds do. And I was really dispirited by my career of writing for children when the idea came to me, not of rewriting The Wizard of Oz. Rewriting The Wizard of Oz was a next step. The first step came to me that I needed to write a little bit about the nature of evil, because I'd been living in London, and the first Gulf War had started, and I noticed the change in my blood pressure and my body temperature when I read a headline that said, Saddam Hussein, the next Hitler. And I saw the application of that word Hitler upon my biophysical mass and the changes in me. And I thought, wow, that's got to be just about the strongest word in the language. Why is that? And I don't know if Saddam Hussein is the next Hitler, I said to myself. But I know how I'm reacting. I'm ready to, you know, pick up a machine gun. I am basically a Quaker. Oh, you know, it was just terrifying. So I began to examine that in myself.
I'm a total pacifist, but I had like 48 hours of, I guess, American rage or something.
Yes. Yes, and I'm not saying of all the, you know, of all the 120 years of past American history, if that war that ensued was possibly the most legitimate, well, World War II was legitimate, was the, you know, what Thomas Aquinas would, you know, call, it met the standards for a just war. But, nonetheless, I was really more interested in my reaction. And at the same time, there was the murder of a 2-year-old child by a 14 and an 11-year-old set of boys who had played hooky from the school. Again, they didn't set out to kill a child that day, but they happened upon a child who wandered away from his mother's apron strings. They fed him ice cream. They took him around the town. This was later documented by the video cameras, surveillance, and security. And by the end of the day, they had stoned him and left him on railroad tracks to make it look as if he'd been run over. Well, the chattering classes in London, and that's where I was living, were all agog, because the laws that obtained about the identification of minors in a situation such as this were not as tight as they are in the United States. They've become tightened since, partly because of this case. So once the boys were identified, I mean, they were identified on the paper, their names and their histories, their ages, every minister from every pulpit, every slightly drunk dinner guest on a Saturday night, every columnist, every talking head on TV was asking the question, how could a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old have gone so wrong so early? How could they be capable of such crime, such maliciousness, such evil? And this is the question I had retired round about sophomore year of college. I had stopped thinking about something that deep because I had long since thought, I'll never be able to answer it. The great philosophers haven't answered it. Jesus didn't answer it. I don't know. Nobody knows. It's just a holy mystery. But I felt compelled to try to answer it for myself. I thought, maybe my subconscious can answer it if my conscious mind can't. I can talk for a long time in a radio station, but I'm actually a very slow thinker, which is why I'm a writer. And so I thought, I'll set myself the narrative experiment of writing about an evil person, and maybe I'll be able to see how they got that way, and I'll know something that hasn't been known before, or at any rate, hasn't been known by me. My first thought was, I'll write about Hitler, of course. About 20 minutes later, I thought, no, I don't have the chops for that. I don't speak German. You get one tiny thing wrong about his biography, and everybody will jump all over you. So I remember that old trope that everybody always says, write what you know. And I thought, what do I know? I know church music, you know, I know guitar music, you know, from after Vatican II. There might be a lot of evil in that, but I don't know where to find it. I know children's books. You know, the whole point of there being children's books is that there's not any real significant evil in them. And then the Virgin Mary came down out of the clouds and blessed me with a vision of Margaret Hamilton saying, I'll get you and your little dog.
You did that frighteningly well.
I thought to myself, you know, Jesus, Mary, Joseph, I've just had a vision. I know
this
story. I
hope everybody watching the radio saw you just cross yourself, but go on.
I know this story. Everybody knows this story. And I had read the novel, and of course I was very familiar with the film, as people of my generation are. And I already knew that L. Frank Baum had given the witch no backstory, and MGM had given the witch no backstory, which meant, unlike the childhood of Hitler, anything that was written about the childhood of the Wicked Witch of the West could not be called wrong by the critics. It was completely open. It was virgin territory for me. And I really did think, this is the idea of a lifetime. And I say,
WBAI, New York.
I saved it until I felt I was a strong enough writer to take it on. I saved it, you know, for a couple of years. And that's really how I came into it. So,
and fortuitously, Oz is public domain.
Well, you know, it is, but I didn't know that when I began. I really am fairly thick, you know. I wrote the entire first draft, the draft ready to send to my agent, and sent it to him. And only after he saw it and he wrote back to me, he said, you know, L. Frank Baum's estate has just come out of copyright protection about 6 months ago. And this is the first book based on his creations that I've seen.
Never mind how many people are capitalizing on Oz. The writer always gets...
Yes, right. So that was just another instance of very, very good luck. Now, having said that, once I began to take up the task of writing about evil, I found that I had lots of other agendas too. And one of them was to take the kind of pasteboard, technicolor, vaudeville, you know, let's put on a show feeling of the movie, which is what most people think of when they think of Oz, the MGM film, and try to apply the dynamic historicity that Tolkien had applied to Middle-earth, or that Ursula Le Guin had applied to Earthsea, to imply that there was a history and everything was not just now, 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 which, of course, we know it is in the United States. But I wanted to see whether I could convert Oz into a land with a deep history, with conflicting social mores and populations, and therefore mirror more accurately both Middle-earth and Earthsea, but also the United States. And that became one of my bounden ambitions.
Yeah. It's wonderfully complex, and you have created sort of, it's not really a parallel universe. You've taken Baum. A lot of people have written a lot of Oz books, and I've had a few of them on, and some of them are actually very good, because it is such a rich palette. But there are so many writers who take other universes, other people's universes, and I shudder what will happen if and when Middle Earth ever truly enters the public domain, or which it probably never will. That is so protected. But Earthsea is not as well protected, probably. Sorry, Ursula. And other such worlds. And people are all, and God knows with the both the blessings and curses of fanfic, what people do to other places.
Right.
But The Wicked Years is so rich, and it is so appropriate in its politics, in its view of its and our world, that it really brings, at this point, a 21st century depth to that universe. And it's really a wonderful thing that you have done here.
Well, it was, you know, my boyfriend at the time, he was we were together for 18 years, was an anthropologist who got his doctorate from Harvard. And when I was about 100 pages
in... A Harvard anthropologist. You don't aim high, do you?
Sorry. I was about maybe 100 pages in, and I said to him, you know, if you were going into the highlands of Iran, which is where he had done his doctoral field work, if you were going to the highlands of Iran and coming upon a culture you hadn't known before, what are the questions you would ask of it? And he rattled off about 18 or 20, immediately conceived topics of interest. And I made a list of them, and I had already begun to cover about 14 of them. Mm-hmm. And it showed that I really wanted to be not just an historian, but an anthropologist. I wanted to put out as much as I could. I mean, if you sat there and said, well, you know, we don't know anything about, you know, dental hygiene in Oz, what, you know, I would apply right now. I would sit here and I would apply not Google Earth, but Google Oz. It would take me a while to get it fired up.
Don't give people ideas.
And I would find some part of the story that had to do with teeth. Well, I'm now just thinking Elphaba in the novel is born with big teeth. She's born with a full set of choppers that bite off the finger of one of the maids in waiting who are helping her mother to give birth. So there's a tooth reference. Now, why? You know, I never really did explain those teeth. It was one of the mysteries. But I feel that I actually have that capacity to sharpen the focus about virtually anything that might be asked. I don't use it unless there's a way in which it brings the story forward or brings the sense of the pathos of the individual characters forward. But I feel at least, you know, until I close this book and put it back on the shelf and start something new, I have that as a sort of skill. I didn't really ask for it, but it's sort of hardwired into me.
Which came first, the sequels to the first Book of the Wicked Years or Mirror, Mirror, and the other fairy tale reworkings?
Well,
and there were some short stories along those lines.
Well, right after I wrote Wicked, and it was published, and it did...
I should explain, a fairy tale fanatic.
Oh, are you really? Wow.
And usually about this time of year, I always do annual shows about why fairy tales are so essential to the human psyche, and they're very much following the Le Guin thinking of why are Americans afraid of dragons. She wrote an essay called From Elfland to Poughkeepsie.
Right, right.
And
essay.
I'll throw in, you know, a little bit of Tolkien, his essays.
Right.
And a smidgen of Bruno Bettelheim without all the Freudian.
Right, right. It's hard to take the Freudian out of Bettelheim.
It really is. Yes. It really is. But nevertheless, it's the fact that it shows how deep into the psyche fairy tales go and how essential they are, and Le Guin's awareness of how America was. Now, she wrote that essay, 35 years ago or something, and that's obviously no longer true, although I see us slipping back from fairy land into comic books. But this season on TV, I haven't seen either of them yet. We have two new TV series that are composed of fairy tales. There's a show called Grimm about a bunch of brothers who go out and deal with fairy tale characters that are, you know, committing murders in our world. And I have forgotten the name of the other Disney-born and yet dark fairy tale TV series that is out there. It has become...
It's called Once Upon a Time. Psyche,
and yet, people still belittle it. It's so funny. It's the poor relation.
Yes. I have several theories about why they last and why we care about them, whether we admit it or not. One theory I have is that, like the parables in the New Testament, they are almost the smallest portable story form that... one can take one with oneself as one, you know, is fleeing a country or is dealing with a, uh, a fractious child on a train who needs to go to the bathroom, but the bathroom is broken. I mean, they can be carried. They are portable, and they can be dressed in any guise. They're like the American Girl dolls. They can be dressed in any costume and still be recognizable for what they are. The other theory I have, and why I actually chose to write Mirror, Mirror, which is
thank
my
you. You actually
my
remembered
on,
my question. That was difficult.
Yes. It's my take on Snow White or Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, which was my take Cinderella. One of the reasons that I do that, or that I have done it, is that I know my books are popular novels, I like to think, that they really are disguised. They're really novels of ideas, but I disguise them as popular novels, and I try to use popular tropes in order to sucker people into reading them without thinking, I want to read about the relative values of beauty and how we assess quality. Mm. That's really what Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister is about. But if I say it's a retelling of Cinderella set in Harlem, Holland in 1628, nobody has to worry about the theme. They'll get the theme like dissolving your aspirin in your orange juice. It's just there in with the joy and delight of the story. But the other thing I think
was the original purpose of fairy tales.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And two other points about fairy tales. One is that as our society does become more fractious and more uncivil, we have less and less in common that we can talk about. I like to think of myself as a very courteous person, but even I find myself, if I find myself in a room with a lot of people talking politics of a sort of which I don't approve, I no longer feel I can engage as well as I thought I might have done 10 years ago. I get angry too, and I think, why should I spend my time? And so we are divided. We're certainly divided in terms of our economy, in terms of our fiscal ballast, and who
we're recording this about 6 blocks from Zuccotti Park.
Yes,
but aside from
exactly
that, at 120 Wall Street,
who's on the up and who's on the down? We're divided in terms of our political opinions. We are either, in many cases in America, we're either fundamentalist believers or we're pagans, and we've forgotten the many, many varieties of religious experience that is legitimate and is shared. We don't have a way of sharing it anymore. But you know what we all have? We all have that language of childhood. Doesn't matter where we ended up, so severed from one another as adults. We all grew up in the country of childhood, and these stories are our holy books. And when we get out of childhood, we carry them with us because they're portable. And they are one of the, maybe 100 years ago, it might have been Greek myths. 200 years ago, it might have been Old Testament stories. But now, the Greek myths don't run across cultural divides. The Old Testament stories don't run across cultural divides anymore in America. But the fairy tales do. And that's why I think, right now,
the sort of secular religion.
Yes.
Secular religious stories, morality.
Religious stories, morality stories, but also it's a lingua franca in the original sense of the term. They're the words that we can all recognize.
Mm-hmm.
No matter who we are, we can all, we know if we put an apple and a mirror on the same table, we know what that's about. We know that's Snow White. We don't even need a little person.
Yeah.
We know an apple and a mirror conjures up the shape, the architectural shape, and the impact of the story of Snow White. And we are automatically all on the same page. Even if you're writing Ann Beatty or somebody is writing a dry New Yorker story, if there's an apple and a mirror in the first paragraph, that story will be read through the prism, subconsciously, I suspect, but we read through the prism of what we all remember about Snow White. This is my firm belief.
Although I always ask, whatever happened to Rose Red? Why does nobody remember
her? Oh, yes.
But anyway. we could do this easily for 5 hours, and it was difficult enough booking you for 75 minutes, but I want to get to a reading.
All right.
If we may. We've hardly gotten up to the second book in the Oz books, but you're going to, sorry, not in the Oz books, The Wicked Years.
I'll accept my Oz books.
Yeah, your Oz books, absolutely, right. Because that is what they are, but it's also branded
right.
as The Wicked Years,
right.
And people should be aware of that, no doubt. And if for no other reasons, that musical has is the elephant in the room.
Yes, it is. And the original book, Wicked, which got all good reviews except for one, sold under the radar.
I have to ask who that was.
Oh, it was Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times.
You're kidding me!
18 column inches of vitriol, but I love you, Michiko, if you're listening. It's all right.
I'm aghast because I have great admiration.
Well, I think that it was hard. I suspect that a lot of readers felt
wrong
this about
Wicked.
Wrong
side of the bed that morning.
Well, exactly. One of my friends said, when she read the review, she said, you know, why doesn't she just kill her husband and be done with it? That's how vitriolic the review seemed. But I think she really just didn't get that I was doing something more than rehabilitating a hero and slaughtering a sacred cow. I was doing something, you know, much broader. But the tropes of the Wizard of Oz film are very strong in everybody's mind.
They are. They are. They're very, very, very difficult to shed. Which is one of the reasons why I love so much all the varied takes and all that stuff. I was one of the few. I did not read Baum until later years.
Uh-huh.
And I think, in a way, I'm the better for it because they are very adult books. They can be read by younger people. But, and I've read many adult books as a younger person and aspired to them and all that, but I was weaning on, the Phantom Tollbooth and a few other
right.
books in that era, 50th anniversary of Phantom Tollbooth this month, and, and you and I are of a similar age, we're 6 months apart, I noted.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, and The Wicked Years are very adult.
Yes, yes, they're published by an adult publisher, and in fact, the original, idea by HarperCollins, published Wicked, was that they would not mention on the dust jacket that I had written for children before. They wanted it to look as if I had sprung from the head of Ozma or Zeus or somebody. And this was in part to protect young readers from being given this book for Christmas, when really it was intended as a very serious exploration of evil. There's philosophy, there's sex, there's no drugs, not in that one. But there's thinking in it, and there's violence. And so the publishers decided, let's just call this Wicked by Gregory Maguire and let people find it. People did
find
it.
Although the cover does tell people where it's from.
Yes, yes, the cover does tell people where
it's
from.
And you've been so lucky with your covers,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, I know. They really are delicious. The books, the hardcovers especially, are like giant boxes of Whitman chocolates. I mean, they're beautiful, creamy, and saturated colors. But the book, despite that one bad review, the book sold very well. It had sold, close to 750,000 copies by hand, by independent booksellers, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
I think Barnes & Noble admired it, too. When the play came out 8 years later, the numbers shot up, of course, because the play became popular, and kids and adults who liked the play enough that they wanted something more found the book in the millions. And my mailbag began to get, just flooded. So it was the combination, really, of the renewed interest that readers were showing with my renewed need to write on the basis of where American history had taken us with mm-hmm. Abu Ghraib and all that, and Guantanamo and stuff, that brought me back to the series, and that the series, which is now concluding with Out of Oz.
And we're going to have to ask about that conclusion, but why don't we go to what I asked you 10 minutes ago before I diverted you 100 different ways, because I know that part of what you're going to read will actually bring us up to date in the story cycle, won't it?
It will, and okay. I'm going to read from the prologue of Out of Oz. It would take Dorothy Gale and her relatives 3 days to reach the mountains by train from Kansas. the conductor told them. No matter what the schoolteacher had said about Galileo, Copernicus, and those other spoil sports, any cockamamie theory that the world was round remained refuted by the geometrical instrument of a rattling train applied to the spare facts of a prairie. Dorothy watched eagles and hawks careering too high to cast shadows. She watched the returning larks and bluebirds, and she wondered what they knew about the shape of the world and if they would ever tell her. Then the Rockies began to ice up along the spring horizon beyond the shoot-em-up town of Denver. Uncle Henry had never seen such a sight. He declared himself bewildered at their height. "They surely do remind me of the great Kells of Oz," agreed Dorothy, "though the Kells looked less bossy somehow." She tried to ignore the glance Uncle Henry shared with Aunt Em. Some of the passes being snowed over, even in early April, the train made slower progress than the timetable had promised. Auntie Em fretted that their hotel room would be given away. Uncle Henry replied with an attempt at savoir-faire. "I'll wire ahead at the next opportunity, Em. Hush yourself and enjoy the nation." What a charade that they were accustomed to taking fancified holidays. They had little extra money for emergencies. Dorothy knew this. They were spending their savings on her behalf. The train chuffed along valleys noisy with rushing waters, inched across trestles as if testing them for purchase. It lollygagged up slopes. One cloudy afternoon, it maneuvered through so many switchbacks that the travelers lost all notion of east and west. In her seat, Dorothy hummed a little. Once she thought she saw a castle on a ridge, but it was only a tricky rock formation. "But I never before saw a rock that looked like a castle," said Aunt Em brightly. "You never saw a castle," thought Dorothy, and tried not to be disappointed. They worried their way through Nevada and its brownish springtime, and at last came down into California through a napland of orchards and vineyards. When the train paused outside Sacramento to take on tinder, Dorothy saw a white peacock strutting along next to the tracks like a general surveying his troops. It paused at her window and fanned out its impossible stitchery. She could have sworn it was a white peacock and that it would speak. But Toto began to yap out the open window, and the bird kept its own counsel. Finally, the train chuffed and shrugged into San Francisco, a city so big and filthy and confounding that Uncle Henry dared to murmur, "This beats your old Emerald City, I'll warrant." "Henry," said his wife, "pursed lips are kind lips." They found their hotel. The clerk was nice enough, a clean young man whose lips weren't so much pursed as rubied. He forgave their delay, but could no longer supply them with a room only one flight up, as they'd been promised. Auntie Em refused to try Mr. Otis's hydraulic elevator, so they had to climb up five flights. They carried their own bags to avoid having to tip. That night, they ate Kaiser rolls they'd bought at the train station. All the next day they stayed in the hotel's penitentially severe room, as Auntie Em recovered from the taxation to her nerves caused by the swaying of railway cars. She could not tolerate being left alone in a hotel chamber on their first day, not when it felt as if the whole building was rocking and bucking as the train had done. Dorothy was eager to go and see what she could see, but they wouldn't let her walk out alone. "A city is not a prairie," Auntie Em proclaimed through the damp washcloth laid from forehead to chin. "No place, no place at all for a compromised girl without a scrap of city wits." The spring air wafting through the open window next morning revived Auntie Em. All these flights up, it smelled of lilacs and hair oil and horse manure and hot sourdough loaves. Encouraged, the Flatlanders ventured outdoors. Dorothy carried Toto in a wicker basket, for old time's sake. They walked up to the carriage entrance of the famous Palace Hotel and pretended they were waiting for a friend so they could catch a glimpse of sinful excess. What an accomplished, offhand manner they showed, sneaking sideways glances through the open doors at the potted ferns, the swags of rust-red velvet drapery, the polished doorknobs. Also the glinting necklaces and earrings and cufflinks and gentlemen's shirts, starched so clean it hurt the eye to look. "Smart enough," said Auntie Em, "for such like who feel the need to preen in public." She was agog and dismissive at once, thought Dorothy, a considerable achievement for a plain-minded woman. "The Palace Hotel is all very well," said Dorothy at lunch, a frankfurter and a sumptuous orange from a stall near Union Square, "but the Palace of the Emperor in the Emerald City is just as great." "I shall be ill, Auntie Em," going pale. "I shall be ill, Dorothy, if, after all we have mortgaged on this expedition, you insist on seeing San Francisco by comparing it to some imagined other world. I shall be quite, quite ill." "I mean nothing by it," said Dorothy. "Please, I'll be still. It's true, I've never seen anything like most of this."
"The world is wonderful enough without your having to invent an alternative," said Uncle Henry.
A tired man by now, not a well man either, and stretched to put things baldly while there was time.
"Who is going to take you in marriage, Dorothy, if you've already given yourself over to delusions and visions?"
"Snares of the wicked one," Aunt Em, spitting an orange seed into the street.
"We have been kind, Dorothy, and we have been patient. We have sat silent, and we have spoken out. You must put the corrupting nightmare of Oz behind you. Close it behind a door and never speak of it again, or you will find yourself locked within it, alone. We aren't going to live forever, and you must learn to manage in the real world."
"I should imagine I'm too young to be thinking of marriage."
"You're already 16, snapped her aunt. "I was married at 17.
Uncle Henry's eyes glinted merrily, and he mouthed across his wife's head at Dorothy, "Too young." Dorothy knew they had her best interests at heart, and it was true that since her delivery from Oz 6 years ago, she had proved a rare creature, a freak of nature. Her uncle and aunt didn't know what to make of her. When she had appeared on the horizon, crossing the prairie by foot, shoeless but clutching Toto, long enough after Uncle Henry and Aunt Em's home had been carried away that they'd built themselves a replacement, her return was reckoned a statistical impossibility. Who rides the winds in a twister and lives to tell about it? Though Kansans set store on the notion of revelation, they were skeptical when asked to accept any whole-cloth gospel not measurable by brass tacks they'd walloped into the dry-goods counter themselves. So, upon her return, Dorothy had been greeted not as a ghost or an angel, neither blessed by the Lord nor saved by a secret pact she must have made with the evil one. "Just touched," concluded the good folks of the district. "Touched in the big fat head." The local schoolchildren, who had often before given Dorothy a wide berth, now made irrevocable their policy of shunning her. They were unanimous, but wordless about it. They were, after all, Christians. She'd learned to keep Oz to herself, more or less. Of course, things slipped out. But she didn't want to be figured as peculiar. She'd taken up singing on the way home from the schoolhouse as a way to disguise the fact that no one would walk with her. And now that she was done with school, it seemed there were no neighbors who might tolerate her company long enough to find her marriageable. So Uncle Henry and Aunt Em were making this last-ditch effort to prove that the workaday world of the Lord God Almighty was plenty rich and wonderful enough to satisfy Dorothy's curiosity for marvels. She didn't need to keep inventing impossible nonsense. "She keeps on yammering about that fever dream of Oz, and she'll be an old spinster with no one to warble to but the bones of Toto. I'm going to jump just to the end of this section. So Dorothy and Auntie Em and Uncle Henry spend a few days in San Francisco, and they go to the edge of the continent trying to see the ocean, because Kansans really don't believe in the ocean until they get to see it with their own eyes. But the day they go, the fog has come in, and while they can hear something, they can't see it. Auntie Em catches a sniffle and declares that the landscape doesn't agree with her, and nor she with it. She goes back to the hotel. Later, she relents. She lets Uncle Henry and Dorothy go out for a meal in a restaurant, and they go to Chinatown, where just before they leave, the lady who has sat them brings Dorothy a cricket in a cage for good luck. Dorothy doesn't really like seeing the cricket in the cage, but there you have it. They come back. Maybe Uncle Henry was right. Maybe there was enough in this world to make her forget Oz. But was that the right motivation for marrying a Kansas farmer, assuming she could land one? Only, she supposed, if he was the right farmer. At the hotel, she begged Uncle Henry that they ride the lift up to their floor. "Your Auntie Em wouldn't approve, fretting for our safety," he replied. "Whether she's around to notice or not, I never behave as she'd disagree with, in honor of her." Dorothy thought, what a set of stairs to walk up. But when they reached the fifth floor, he winked at her and kept going. 3, 4 more flights. She followed wordlessly. At the top level, they found a door. It opened easily enough to reveal to them a glowing cityscape. The canyons between buildings were running with light and sound. On the electric blue darkness, all around Dorothy and Uncle Henry, hung the illuminated windows of people in rooms, a museum of their living lives, golden squares and rectangles. "Oh," she exclaimed, "no fibbing. It's better than the Emerald City. But where's the ocean? Which way? We're so high. Can we see it?" They worked out which direction to look. This late at night, there was nothing that way except for darkness.
"That empty place, without light," said Uncle Henry. "It must be there, though you can't see it."
"Some say that about other places," she replied, but not harshly. "Beyond the ocean, what's there?"
"The land of the Japanese and the Chinese. A whole society of them, all talking in that singy-song way they got."
"And the ocean," she could hardly bear it. "What's it like?"
"I ain't never seen it yet, but tomorrow we can come back up here."
She was lost that night when she finally managed to sleep. In the raspy claw of dreams that wouldn't declare themselves fully, the cricket chirped on one side of her, and Uncle Henry wheezed in concert. As the first light weakened the blackness of sky, but long before dawn, Toto began to whine.
"Hush! Auntie Em is feeling poorly after our long trip," whispered Dorothy, but Toto needed to go outside.
Dorothy hunched herself into her clothes and grabbed the cricket cage and let herself out of the room, leaving the door open a crack so she could return without disturbing her worthy relatives. Didn't take long to find Toto a scrap of junk ground in which to do his business. Dorothy turned her head. Many of the lights were lowered now, but there was a strange apprehensiveness to the street, like the setting of a stage in which a play was about to begin. The charcoal of the night decayed into a smokier shade. "Come on. We'll be in all manner of trouble if they find us out on the street alone," said Dorothy. "Let's go up." In the lobby, she saw the elevator man, asleep in a lounge chair, his head to one side and his little cap askew. In that funny high-waisted jacket, he looked like a flying monkey she'd once known. How were they ever affording this poor dear Henry and Em, late of the Kansas Prairie? So frightened of her, so eager for an acceptable future, she would make it worth their while. She stepped into the cage and pulled the door shut. The door was fretted like sets of linked scissors, like the threads of an old apron if you scrub it too hard with lye, connected to itself, but airy. There was a single control as far as she could see. She gripped the brass handle and revolved it a full half-turn, and the floor began to lift with Toto and Dorothy and the cricket inside. She almost squealed, but she knew the merest sound might wake the elevator attendant, and she risked being put in jail for ambushing a lift and taking it on a joyride. The perforated rooms sailed up past the fifth floor all the way to the ninth, which led to the roof. She remembered. She tiptoed from the elevator cabin and shouldered her way through the door into the chill of dawn above the ocean. In the few moments she'd been rising in the lift, the sky had lightened that much more. The buildings at this hour seemed less defined by light. They looked like stone formations left behind after some unimaginable geologic event. She could make out a tongue of sea beyond the buildings to the west, but no sound from this far away, no apparent motion, only a lapidary expanse dimming and shading into the night. No horizon line, just endlessness, sea and sky inseparable. Toto began to whimper and to jump around as if he wanted to leap from the ninth floor. "It's not frightening. It isn't," she said, though she didn't know whether she was trying to convince herself or the dog. "It's just the ocean and another world on the other side. You know all about that. You're the best traveled mutt in history, Toto. Stop your fussing. What are you fussing about?" The dog appeared to be going mad, running in circles around her and yipping in some sort of distress. Dorothy set the cricket cage upon the stone barrier that kept people from falling off the flat roof. "You can come out," she said to the cricket. "I make my own luck, you make yours. Nobody should live in a cage. Never surrender to that." The cricket emerged and rubbed some scratchy parts of itself together. Whether it leaped or whether the wind took it, Dorothy couldn't say. The cricket guest was there one moment and gone the next. "Safe landing," she called lightly after it. "Oh, all right, Toto. Stop your infernal fussing. The wind isn't going to take you, too. Once in your life was enough." She picked up the dog and went back into the building. The elevator was where she had left it, quivering at this height. She would ride it down to the fifth floor and go in and rest next to her uncle and aunt. She had spied something of the ocean, some little hem of it. The globe was round. She could see there was another world beyond this one. That would have to do. Some corn-blind farmer, walled on four sides of his life by superior alfalfa, was waiting for her. She began her descent. She passed the eighth floor and the seventh. At 5:15 on the morning of April 18th, 1906, the buildings of San Francisco started to shake.
It really was no miracle. What happened was just this. The wind began to switch, the house to pitch, and suddenly the hinges started to unhitch. Just then, the witch, to satisfy an itch, went flying on her broomstick, thumbing for a hitch.
And oh, what happened then was rich.
The house began to pitch, and the kitchen took a stitch. It had an uncle wicked witch in the middle of a ditch. Witch, so not a healthy situation for the wicked witch. The house began to pitch, and the kitchen took a stitch. It had an uncle wicked witch in the middle of a ditch. Witch, so not a healthy situation for the wicked witch. Who began to twitch, and was reduced to just a stitch.
This is WBAI in New York City, Hour of the Wolf, and you're listening to a recorded interview with author Gregory Maguire.
So, that's okay. How it starts.
Yeah.
Dorothy, later on, when she's on trial, sings a song. I can't remember it offhand, but she's trying to convince the jury about how she got to Oz, that she wasn't going there in order to do more mayhem and kill more witches. And and she gets carried away with the force of her own rhetoric, and she starts to say, the house began to shake, the wind to break. And I've, actually, there's a whole long string of it. I can't recall it at the moment. I sang it last night at a book reading, but I had the page marked, and I don't have it marked right today.
Yeah. How would you describe Out of Oz as a book overall? What is, I mean, obviously, it's the trial of Dorothy Gale.
It is the trial of Dorothy Gale. That's the centerpiece. But it is also, yet again, another story about how people without power must nonetheless get on in a world that insists powerless people are dispensable. That has been, in some ways, the recurring theme of the series. But the
I'm sorry, the words Occupy Oz enter my head.
Yes, exactly. Occupy Oz. You've got it. The two big O's. Out of Oz, the three O's, and Occupy Oz is the two O's, and the one O is just O. But Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West in Wicked, was a woman with great power, conviction, and talent. She had intellectual prowess. She was based in part on Virginia Woolf. But the characters in Oz after she leaves, the ones that I have concentrated on, her son Lear in Son of a Witch, the Cowardly Lion in A Lion Among Men, and finally in this book, not really Dorothy, but Rain, the little green-skinned girl who's born at the end of Son of a Witch, that is to say, Elphaba's granddaughter. They are the central players in these three books, and Rain is the central player in this final novel. They have none of Elphaba's magnificent capacity, but they have all of her need. So they have to find different ways in which to get on in a world which is distressing and needs a little bit of perfecting.
Yeah, it's it resonates so well, and I suspect that these books, like Baum's books, will be, you know, well celebrated for their centenary and beyond. Why an end?
Well, people used to say, why a sequel? If The Wicked Witch of the West, you know, kind of disappears when Dorothy splashes her at the end of Wicked, how can you write a sequel to a book in which the main character is gone? But remember, you asked me at the beginning the whole title of the book, and the whole title of the book is Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. The pilgrims knew full well that our times last beyond us. As long as there is someone in the world who can make a life decision based on something they actually remember of a person who is gone, then the person who is passed still has influence. It is still her time. So we say, in a certain sense, that the times of a person are five generations. Most biographies begin with who the grandparents were and then how the parents were raised before they get to the child, because the times of those grandparents affected the subject in question. And similarly, once the subject in question is gone, that subject's times affect down unto two generations. So the reason that Out of Oz comes to an end, and I consider that I have drawn the story to a close, is multiple. But one reason is that there is now enough time passed from the disappearance of Elphaba at the end of Wicked and the end of Out of Oz that I think it's no longer fair to call these the Wicked years. Maybe, who knows, maybe I'll start a different series, and it will be the years beyond the Wicked years. It'll have a different
because
title.
Because, after all, Baum did so many books that had nothing to do with Dorothy Gale.
That's right. She became a bit player. She was a little bit like, you know, Carol Channing. They trotted her out once in a while on the stage, and she sang a little bit, and then they put her in a wheelchair and pulled her back. I mean, she was no longer the main event after a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always had a thing for Glinda anyway. But so you're not necessarily done with Oz, just with the Wicked years.
Well, I feel as if I'm done with Oz, but I am honest enough to know that I don't know where I'm going next.
Which was the next question, of course.
Yes. This has been a 16-year exercise in anthropology, cultural anthropology of Oz. And I would like to think that if I clear the air and sit very, very still for a while, another voice might speak to me or sing to me. Maybe it won't, but I want to give it a chance just in case it should. I'd really love to try to write for the theater now that I've had a lot of time.
I was getting to that. Yes.
So.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about other media, but also specifically about theater. Obviously, given your background, I'm surprised you haven't gone there already, Stephen Schwartz notwithstanding. Because, I mean, that's a fun show, and I haven't seen it, but from what I know of it, it deviates as much from your book as the 1939 movie does from Baum's book.
Yes, the ratio is almost exact. You've got it. You've got that perfect. That's a perfect statement. I think it's very true.
Yeah. So your voice with in the theater.
I like to think that I have a cadence of drama in, even if there's only a couple of characters talking, they sound to me like they could be saying their lines on a stage. I mean, they sound in my ear when I'm writing as if they are spoken lines to an audience. And so it would be fun to do. But also, I'm 57, and I have been writing fiction professionally for 32 years, and unprofessionally, you know, about 14 years before that. Is that right? Well, at least 10 years before that. And so I suppose I could retire if I wanted. But what I really want to do is to clarify myself and maybe, what's the yoga word, purify myself a little bit and see the world hasn't stopped changing and I have not yet left it. So I wonder if I give it the opportunity, if I extend the invitation to the muse, will she show up again? Mm-hmm. And in what way? Now, once she showed up, you know, I used to laugh and say, you know, the muse arrives at the wolf who comes howling at the door because you can't afford your dinner. And there might be some truth to that. On the other hand, I don't really believe that. I think a lot of people write and they make things because not to do it makes them feel physically ill.
I would think. And besides that, there's always life. You're a married man with three children.
That's right.
And, you know, I was looking last night. I didn't know that much about your background. But while I was on the air playing my interview with Jeff Ryman, I was looking you up. And I was looking at your husband's paintings, Andrew Newman.
Yes.
I swear I've seen his work.
You might have done. He has shown in New York. And he shows, actually, a lot in Europe and a lot in New England, and I don't know that he has a gallery in New York City at the moment, but he has shown here.
Yeah, so there's always life.
Yes.
Something else, right. That you can do.
We get together. He comes home from the studio at lunch, and every day we have lunch together, and we spend about the first 15 minutes talking about, you know, the trials of the particular salt mine in which we're laboring with our art, and then we spend the next 20 minutes talking about the kids and what's gone wrong with them in the last 24 hours that we have to sort out.
I mean, I know that it's fraught with problems and its issues and all that, but it sounds like an idyllic life. It really does. You're both working in art. You're happily married. You have kids. I mean.
Right. And, you know, in terms of.
What does somebody want out of life?
In terms of the social, you know, the social questions about two men having children, I continue to protest to this day that the thing that really characterizes our children's life as different from their peers is that both their parents work at home, effectively. We both see them on the school bus in the morning, and we are both at the end of the driveway when the bus comes home at 3:20.
So they're getting every bit of care.
Okay, yes. And
a storyteller for one.
Yes, yes, right.
You know, it's and an artist for another. I mean, I think that's, you know, a pretty good legacy.
Sometimes when an interviewer comes to the house, especially if an interviewer has a film camera, the interviewer will approach those delicate little children and say politely, what does it feel like to be living here in a house and being raised by a famous artist and a famous writer? And the kids say in chorus, blah, 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 blah. You know, they are kids, and they scorn us as is their right and bound in duty so that they may take their own place in the world when the time comes.
And it'll be very interesting to see what that place is.
Oh, won't it ever?
Yeah. Well, I would like to talk for about another hour. or two, and then take phone calls. But it is time for us to start wrapping up. And I don't even begin to know. I mean, there, I am now having l'esprit de scalier, all the things that I would like to have discussed and where we could go down to the meaning of the tales. Is the name Burr have anything to do with Bert Lahr? the other fairy tale books will, will you be writing? Will your future writings even be in the world of fairy, which forms of fairy? It's such a wide world of imagination, not to mention the world in which we live.
Yes, and it is endlessly compelling. I mean, I used to, when I was about 14, I used to hide fairy tales in stacks of realistic boys' novels in order to smuggle them out of the library without being embarrassed, the way sometimes people buy pornography and stick it between a Newsweek and a New Yorker. I was a little bit ashamed at 14. I thought there's got to be, I probably should outgrow this, and I haven't. But I still haven't, but I've outgrown my shame.
Yeah, excellent. Yes. So, again, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and I'll come back anytime I'm in the city.
Fabulous.
Thanks.
You've been listening to an interview with author Gregory Maguire. Among other things, he's best known for The Wicked Years and his latest book, Out of Oz. Over Hour of the Wolf on WBAI, New York. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. We have, 3 minutes in which to squeeze in a couple of calls, if you'd like. It's at 212-209-2900. A reminder, next Tuesday, December 6th, doors open at 6:30, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, hosted by Claire Wolf Smith, produced by, I guess that would be moi, and featuring the wonderful, fantastic Over the Rainbow people of Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. And for more information, go to my website, ourwolf.com, and look at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Yes, Jim, I just wanted to say, a wonderful program, and I know you won't believe this, but I have an idea where your author should go next.
My author should go next?
Well, I mean, your interview person. But, I mean, he was wonderful.
No, he's great. He didn't become a bestseller by not being wonderful.
Well, I'll tell you something. You always delight me, even when you give me a hard time about 1984.
There you go.
Carry on and be well.
Okay, you too.
Okay, next call, please.
Okay, next call, please. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
I hope he has lots of Oz if he feels like it, but there's one thing I would love him to do, and that is a book of Oz myths and legends. There is so much in there.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I mean, he has folktale ideas. I mean, even among the tribes of the Vincas, there are legends, and I would love to him to do maybe a book of songs.
Well, as you heard him say... he's been doing Oz for 16 years. He is a man of letters and a great many thoughts.
He takes no prisoners. Takes no prisoners. One other quick thing.
But he is going to take a break.
Yeah, with the San Francisco earthquake, I mean, I knew it was coming. I don't know how I knew, but when that elevator went down...
You knew it when it was Dorothy Gale in San Francisco in 1906.
And by the way...
What other possibility could there be?
Yes, and one other thing...
It wasn't going to be a twister.
No. An elevator falling and killing a cow is amazing. Now, one last thing. The song that Dorothy sang in the courtroom, boy, she can't win for anything because none of the folks, even her owlish defense attorney, Temper Bailey, couldn't believe when she starts singing America the Beautiful, and they can't understand the spacious grains and the amber mountain waves.
Well, as Gregory points out, actually, amazing. Oz is as big as the U.S.
It is, and the whole idea that beyond that deadly sands there's another world, and when she let the cricket out, I almost felt the same way as when Rain took the broom and went off the edge of the cliff and just flew beyond the deadly sands to find what other world was out there. Just an amazing interview. One of the best you've ever done.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And we'll try to sneak in one more call. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there.
Hi. Well, first of all, congratulations for the program. It's the first time I hear it in spite of my almost 30 years listening to BAI. And it's just a technical question. I missed the name of the artist, the visual artist partner of the person you were interviewing.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. At this moment, I've forgotten. You can find it's Andrew Eek. But if you go to Wikipedia and look up Gregory Maguire, that was my guest, Maguire, it not only will have the name of his husband, but also links to his artwork and stuff like that, which is fabulous stuff.
I hope so. I was thinking that perhaps Wikipedia would not list family relations like that, but I'll give it a try.
Yeah, I'm thinking now it's Newman, but I'm not quite sure.
Gregory Newman. Okay, great.
No, Andrew Newman. Gregory Maguire, Andrew Newman.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, then, thank you all for listening. Sadly to say, we're out of time. It was a very enervating program. Gregory is a wonderful interview, and we hope to have him back. Tune in again next week. I'm not quite sure what's going on because, well, it's the FD time, fun drive. But hopefully we'll have programming for you. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way on these same airwaves. Good morning.
Silver. the 30 years that I've known Lister, I've only wanted one thing, that someday he would produce a reggae version of If I Only Had a Brain, and I know he will. I'm Randy Cohen. I write the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, and you can listen to Lister on WUSB 90.1 FM in Stony Brook and Pacifica Radio WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
Expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm messy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ash. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass?
Sometimes it sounds so good. Jim Prine, great show. Great show this morning, Jim Prine. Now, Robert Knight, great show this morning. 99 Sync, Alistair Live, OWS, y'all. Here we go. As what? Sister from another planet, your favorite group, as what on the air right here, 99 Cinco, y'all. Yeah.
Don't bother with your fussing and your fighting. Don't bother with your fussing and your fighting. Don't do that.
Yo, Reggie, great show last night. Reggie Johnson, good to hear your voice on the radio. Wicked show last night. Overnight style. Hear this.
There's so much things that you and I could do to help this situation. I mean, instead of talking heavy on the blues and stirring up the nation. I know that the love is over you, but what are we supposed to do?
Yeah. Slacksters. All the slackers, we do this until 5 o'clock. Free speech radio news kicks in, and then Al Jazeera news, and then brand new wake up call at 6 o'clock. Amy Goodman on the case. Democracy now more than ever. This is 99 Cinco, Lista Live. Dun, dun, dun. Yo, Jeannie Hopper on the weekends on Sabado, Tony Ryan on Sabado. Yeah, nobody with a fuss and fighting. This is 99.5. 99 Cinco. Here we go.
Nobody with you fussing and your fighting.
Saw this group at the Ritz one time, you know. Who was hanging out? Jackson Brown came to see them too at the Ritz. Hanging out with Aswad here in New York City. So wicked we had to name it twice. 212-209-2900, get it off your chest, you know what to do. Monroe, you know what to do. Your kind of show. Sit back, roll a big head, fatty spliff, y'all. And burn, baby, burn, y'all. Yes, I am.